from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Apple does so much more than make nifty gadgets like the iPad and iPhone. Google is so much more than a search firm. These companies are global Goliaths now, and they're competing with each other for world domination. Whether you're thrilled by the technological innovations or appalled by their growing lock on our lives, it pays to read up on recent history if you want to know where this rivalry is moving next. Dogfight by Wired Magazine's contributing editor Fred Vogelstein tells the story of the rapidly evolving fight between Apple and Google over who's going to own our eyeballs in the 21st century. That's after this on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Michael Krasny. Most of us have trouble keeping up with the latest user interface updates from Apple and Google, let alone the political machinations and engineering behind the scenes. We've all heard of Steve Jobs, Larry Page, and Sergey Brin, but the details of how they built their empires largely escape us. Wired Magazine contributing editor Fred Vogelstein dug into those details to write his new book, Dogfight, and he joins us now to talk about the past, the present, and the future. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, you know, reading Dogfight, I couldn't help but be struck by the fact that the names and products have changed, but business in Silicon Valley looks like business everywhere else that we're aware of. Detroit, the Vatican, you know, gosh, Washington, D.C. It's an ugly business.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the things that sometimes the Valley is a place of reinvention. And I think the Valley is a place where people go to kind of think about the future. And I think the people who are part of the Valley really are coming up with products who are changing the world. But one of the things that's really interesting to note is that they haven't changed human nature. Greed and avarice and jealousy and corporate infighting are as old as really the human race. And that goes on today and will go on for as long as most of us are alive.
Until the robots take over.
It's
coming. But I'm curious, is that the story that you wanted to tell, the emotional heart of Dogfight?
I think the emotional heart of Dogfight is about many things, but it's about really just how hard it is to do what these guys are doing. I think we take all these products that we carry around in our pockets for granted, but I think what we forget is that it's not trivial to do things like create the iPhone or create the Android phones or to create the tablets that we now use. And it's not trivial to bring them to market and get them off the ground. I think that it's just, and I wanted to kind of give people a sense of just how hard it was to make some of this stuff actually happen.
You give a great deal of detail explaining about how Steve Jobs wrangled a cast of thousands. He's a man who got a biopic from Hollywood. You know, books have been written, but not that much has been written about the people who really did make it happen, make the iPhone happen, make the iPad happen, that kind of thing.
One of the things that I think I wanted to do is, you know, you learn a lot by talking to people like Steve Jobs, and you learn a lot by talking to people like Eric Schmidt and Larry Page. But oddly, you learn more by talking to the people two or three levels down in organizations than you do talking to them. I mean, these are the people who are really on the front lines, who lived with this on a daily basis. And so, for example, I mean, you know, what most people don't realize, and it's, gosh, 7 years almost to the day that the iPhone was unveiled. You know, so 7 years ago, almost to the day, the folks at Apple were sweating bullets over the unveiling of their new device.
The top engineers were playing a drinking game.
Well, I mean,
every successful, aspect of the phone.
It was bananas. It was bananas. It was bananas. I mean, they were so worried that the iPhone was going to crash while Steve Jobs was on stage showing it off to the world for the first time that they were sitting in the fifth row doing shots. I mean, one of the engineers brought a flask, and each time Steve Jobs showed off a part of showed off something that was that they worked on and did it in a way that it actually worked, they would do a drink out of the flask. And so, you know, by the end of the demonstration, they were not only elated, they were also drunk. I mean, the stuff that they had to do to kind of get this to actually work is just astonishing. You know, the Wi-Fi in the iPhone didn't really work right, so they actually attached antenna wire and ran it off stage. They actually soldered it inside the phone and then ran it off stage so it worked. The cell phone inside the iPhone didn't work right, so they hard-coded it to always show 5 bars. I mean, they knew that the phone call that Steve Jobs was going to make during the demo was actually going to be would probably work, but they also knew that for the 90 minutes that the phone was on screen in front of the entire world, that the phone would probably crash 2 or 3 times. They didn't want the world seeing the 5 bars go from 4 to 3 to 2 to 1 and then back up again. I mean, they even went as far as to actually come up with an entirely scripted way known as the Golden Path that Steve Jobs was to actually demonstrate the phone. So if he showed, for example, if he played some music, if he did some email, if he surfed the internet, if he did it in that order, the iPhone worked perfectly. If he did it out of order, the iPhone would crash.
So there it is, a tale of smoke and mirrors, but it's also a story of, I don't know, a dictator who forced brilliant minds to come up with something that has proved to be truly wonderful for a lot of people.
I mean, I think it's actually a testament to Steve Jobs' brilliance and his innovation and his skill at innovation. I mean, a lot of people, when Steve Jobs died, and even now, people debate about whether or not he was really an innovator or whether or not he was just a packager, someone who took existing technologies and repackaged them in ways that people that actually worked better. And I think the answer is that's true, except to me, that's the definition of innovation. I mean, understanding the right timing to actually put a whole bunch of components together in a package and sell them is really brilliance in and of itself. I mean, Henry Ford didn't invent the car, but most people think he did. And I think that that's really, it's really an amazing legacy. I mean, the iPhone, essentially, Steve Jobs bet the company on the iPhone. I mean, he pulled all the top engineers off what they were working on at Apple to get them to work on the iPhone. And had he not done that, it would probably have never gotten off the ground. I mean, it's actually an interesting thing to think about when you think about Apple going forward.
Somebody needed to crack the bullwhip.
Well, I mean, and somebody, I think it sort of even goes beyond that. You know, I think that Tim Cook is one of the most brilliant executives running around. I really do. I mean, and I think that Apple has performed quite well under him. one of the things that remains to be seen, and I'm hoping that he can do this, is whether or not he can really take the kinds of risks that Steve Jobs was able to take. You know, I think the difference between success and failure in Silicon Valley is whether or not you can actually take the kinds of enormous risks that's with the company that you run that Steve Jobs took with Apple, or for that matter, that Google took with Android. And what isn't yet clear is whether or not Tim Cook has the flexibility inside of Apple to actually do stuff like that.
So this book is called Dogfight. We could put a colon in there if we want, even though it's not on the cover. How Apple and Google Went to War and Started a Revolution. You could have used the title of one of your chapters, I Thought We Were Friends. Were the top people at Apple and Google ever really friends?
Oh, I think they were. I mean, this is the thing that people forget. I mean, going back to 2006, Apple and Google actually were not only friends, they were sort of the yin and yang of the technology world. I mean, Eric Schmidt was actually on Apple's board of directors in 2006.
Steve, Larry, and Sergey used to take walks with each other?
Yep. I mean, in the early days of Google, when its VCs were pressuring Larry and Sergey to hire a more seasoned CEO, this is going back into the 2000-2001, they said quite publicly that the only person that they would consider would be Steve Jobs. Well, this infuriated their VCs because everybody knew that Steve Jobs had just returned to Apple and wasn't going to leave Apple to go work, to go run Google. But it was more than just a kind of cheeky response. I mean, it was an example of the kind of admiration that Larry and Sergey had for what Steve Jobs had done and what he'd created. And that affection was returned in kind. And I think that when Apple and Google teamed up in 2006, you have to remember, going back in 2006, the enemy wasn't Apple or Google, it was Microsoft. I mean, you know, it's amazing how fast technology moves, but even in 2006, Google and Apple together were both desperately worried that Microsoft was going to take over the mobile phone world and that both of them were going to be, were going to have a hard time competing with that. And so I think that
It almost sounds like a Godfather film. So Google then decided to build its own smartphone platform to fend off the big gorilla from from Washington State. Losing their best friend in the process.
Well, I think what happened was, you know, Eric Schmidt, actually, to his credit, when I talked to him for the book, said, you know, people forget that, you know, if you'd use hindsight, it looks like we intend that we had all this, these plans involved when we were doing this. But you have to remember, going back into 2007, nobody knew whether or not Android or the iPhone, for that matter, was going to get the kind of traction and be as revolutionary a product as both of them turned out to be. And so we were just trying to think about a bunch of different ways to go at this problem. And so obviously the iPhone was a very, very important device that we wanted to get behind, but we didn't know whether or not the iPhone was going to work. And so it seemed to make sense to us to actually try to get going on our own effort. Now, by the end of 2007, I think that things had changed quite meaningfully inside of Google. I actually think that the huge success of the iPhone made them actually start worrying that the enemy wasn't going to be Microsoft, but indeed was going to be Apple. And I think that's when the tension really started.
I suppose as customers and maybe as citizens in a democracy, we should want these companies to compete with each other, right? Instead of collude?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that we're seeing every day the benefits of that competition. I mean, I think I saw some data a month or so ago that said that the average price of a smartphone is now, I don't know, $125 less than it was just 3 years ago. I mean, I think the average price unsubsidized of a smartphone is now under $300. I think $275. The projections have it going below $200 in the next 3 years. Now, I don't know whether or not you can get an iPhone for that, but or the top-of-the-line Android phone for that. But the point is that the competition that these guys have going on is turning out to be wonderful for consumers. And it's not just the devices themselves that are coming down in price. They're having a feature war. And so if you actually look at the kinds of things that both of them are putting in their devices, the kinds of software and features that they're putting in their devices, they're really trying to one-up each other really every single year.
But what about the dark side of all of this? We've become attracted, devoted, obsessed with our smartphones. But then on the flip side, we're also getting locked into systems that are collecting our data and selling it to advertisers and, I suppose, giving it to governments that ask for it. Do you worry that we're headed into some kind of a future where we're going to be stuck with I don't know, corporate conglomerates that don't have our best interests at heart?
You know, I should worry, but I have a hard time worrying. I certainly worry less than I did sort of – I think we certainly should worry less now, for example, than we might have when Microsoft controlled every single PC that we used. You know, the thing that is really going on right now is that not only do you have Apple and Google kind of going at it full bore, but underneath that platform, those two platforms, you have a whole bunch of other companies like Facebook and Amazon and Netflix, and I'm sure I'm leaving others out, that are also really trying to elbow each other aside. And so, yes, they're all collecting data on us and what we're doing, although I think all of them are pretty good about letting us know that they are, in fact, collecting that data. And I think all of them understand, though, that one slip and their competitor gets all your customers. I mean, you know, I think that if it came out that Google was doing or Amazon, that if Google was doing stuff with our data that was truly unacceptable to us.
What is truly unacceptable, though? That line seems to be moving.
Well, I think that's a very good question. You know, one of the things that, you know, I think the most important thing, I think what's unacceptable is sort of in the eyes of the beholder. I mean, we obviously know that what the government was doing and what the NSA was doing is unacceptable. And I think that's actually why what Edward Snowden has done is and will ultimately be determined to be a public service. But beyond that, it's hard to define because I think it means different things to different people. You know, one person may find it terribly upsetting that all these companies are collecting data on them, and their neighbor may find it actually quite helpful because as a result of collecting all that data, they get much more relevant advertising and other products
aimed
at them.
I've never heard any friend say, you know, I really enjoy getting relevant advertising. It makes my life better.
Well, that's because they don't actually – I think that's because the question is put not necessarily in the right way. I think if you were to actually, for example, go look at what users – go look at the behavior of users on a Google search page, for example, and look at the number of people that click on the ads versus the number of people that click on the search results, I think you'd actually be astonished at how many people actually click on the ads. This is the secret to Google's success. They've managed to put advertising in front of people that they don't necessarily even think is advertising. So they're not necessarily conscious about it. That's what's so beautiful about it in that context. But the thing that's really important to understand is that I think all these companies are pretty good at telling people, if you don't want X, you can opt out. Now, I think Google could go one step further. So, for example, I still run into people who are unnerved by the fact that relevant advertising shows up in there when they go to Gmail, for example. So you pull up your Gmail inbox and all of a sudden it looks as if Google has been reading your email because it's based on all the emails that are in your inbox. It's sending you relevant advertising.
So now, sorry to hear about that bad knee surgery. You really should develop a better relationship with your manager at work.
I can't tell you the number of relevant advertising I've gotten about my book Dogfight over the course of the past few months. I keep getting. Once a day, I always get a relevant advertisement from somebody saying that I should probably think about buying Dogfight. It always makes me laugh. And yet, before all of this, all we did was complain about the amount of junk mail that we got that was completely irrelevant to us. And so, but you know, I think Google, for example, could allow people to pay not to get advertising in, say, their Gmail. I've always felt that Google should give consumers the option to do that.
After all, this is about consumer choice and design, taking the human being at the end of this process into thought at the beginning of the process when making the product.
Absolutely. And so I think that these companies could, in some cases, be a little bit more direct and open about this. But by and large, they're doing an okay job.
We're talking with Fred Vogelstein about Dogfight, his new book about the rivalry between Apple and Google. What would you like to know about the way these companies are competing for control of your attention? Call us at 866-733-6786, email us at forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about Dogfight, a new book about the rivalry between Apple and Google. Author Fred Vogelstein is here in studio. You know, this is not just a fight about technology. It's really a fight about entertainment, about what we want to watch and how.
You know, the thing that I think people lose sight of when they focus on the fight between Apple and Google is that it looks like it's really just a fight for king of the hill in high tech. And the answer is it is. But it's a fight also for our eyeballs. You know, what I think most of us forget, because we all take the devices that we carry around for granted, is that we're really walking around with portable televisions in our pocket. And I think Google and Apple, and for that matter, many of the tech companies, understand this. And I think going forward, I think that's something that people are just beginning to kind of get their heads around. I think that what you'll start to see, in fact, in my opinion, is both these companies, as well as their competitors, actually start to finance some of the content that we see. I mean, you know, even the definition of television is changing. I mean, you go back before people had these devices, somebody would say, I'm going to watch TV. And that was an unambiguous statement. If somebody says they're going to watch TV now, it leaves open a lot of, it actually creates more ambiguity than anything else. I mean, so are they going to watch the TV, the big TV, or are they going to go watch a show on their iPhone or their iPad? I mean, right now, if I'm watching Netflix's House of Cards on my iPhone or my iPad, or for that matter, my tablet or Android device or whatever, am I watching television? It sure feels to me like I'm watching television, but I'm certainly not watching television the way I was brought up to think of it.
And I suppose you could say that it's more relevant entertainment in the sense that you get to choose it. You get to choose when you watch it, for how long. We're getting a lot of comments about advertising. I thought we should roll back into that subject. Walt writes, Rachel may not have heard anybody praise relevant ads, but they are less awful than the, quote, one weird trick to reduce belly flat junk that actively insults readers.
You know, I think that relevant advertising, you know, there's a good and there's a bad. I mean, with technology, there's sort of no free lunch, right? So with the internet, there's this incredible communication and news and information system. There's also porn, you know.
Whatever you're conceivably interested in, you can find.
Absolutely. And so one of the great things, so with relevant advertising, you wind up, you get advertising that is more informative. The downside is that you wind up giving up a little bit of information about yourself in order to get that relevant advertising. I think that if people felt like they were going to have to go back to getting ads that meant nothing to them, they might object.
They might object. Let's turn now to the phones and Kathy in Santa Clara.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am a college instructor, and one of the classes I teach is called Information Competency. And your comments, Rachel, about the advertising were right on point, but it's really interesting because one of the assignments I do in my class is to have students watch a video, a TED Talk, of Eli Pariser talking about the filter bubbles. And it's kind of interesting because I have them do a discussion on that afterwards. And one of the things that I'm asking them is whether they're bothered by the idea that their results are being filtered. And there's always some people, of course, who say yes, but what's amazing to me is the number of people who say no, they really mind it, don't mind getting online advertisements or filtered results because it's so much more on target for what they want. And as a 50-something teacher, that blows my mind, but to my 20-something student, it seems perfectly normal.
Kathy, do you ever ask your...
to instill in them as part of that same lesson is that the results that come up, the sponsored ads that come up, are not necessarily all commercial ads, and they're not necessarily all bad sites to go to, but they have to beware because they have to know the difference between which results on their screen are coming up as advertising and which ones are coming up as part of the actual search algorithm. It's not so bad if you're searching for something on cancer treatment and you get a sponsored site that comes up that's directly relevant to that, as long as you know why that site popped up there.
Kathy, do you ask your students about where the line is between what they're comfortable with and what your students are uncomfortable with?
Not directly, although I may start incorporating that into the questions.
Let's thank you, Kathy. That's a great comment. Let's turn now to Noel in Houston.
Hi there. Mr. Vogelsang made a comment earlier about something to the nature of you'd be surprised how many people click on ads in a Google search. And that needs a lot of qualification beyond what he said, because a lot of people don't realize they're clicking on ads in a Google search. They do not know that the first three or four hits in the pink shaded area is actually an advertisement. I've seen this many, many times myself.
Some comments here. Eugene writes, information gathering is not the problem. Information gathering without my consent is the problem. Mike from Berkeley writes, Google is about advertising. It's particularly disappointing. The internet is owned and operated by advertising. It is a universe of hustle that drives Mike nuts. Thank you, Noel, for your question. Gary in North Carolina.
Yes, one of the things that your guest brought up was the fact that you can opt out of a lot of these requirements for filtering and things like that. All our devices have all of these tools to screen out cookies and to block this and have private browsing. And yet more and more, to access any programs or website, they require you to disable all of that stuff just so that you can use it. And Facebook is one of the worst for that. So how can you have any anonymity or do the types of things that you would like to do and yet not give up all your personal data?
Do you want to answer that?
I think that one of the points that you make and I think that is important to make here is the notification issue. I think we've all come to understand how we feel when our data is collected without our notification. I think probably one of the biggest stories over the course of the past year is our discovery about how much the government and the NSA has been, how much information the government and the NSA has been collecting about us without our notification. And I think that's the thing that gets people irate, is when we feel like people are effectively digging through our digital trash. But in terms of what to do with companies like Facebook and Google and others, I wish I could be super specific there, because, you know, I'm one of these people that actually doesn't mind when these companies collect data on me. I mean, let's be clear, I don't give my data out willy-nilly to anybody. And so, you know, when there are apps that I don't trust asking for my data, I often decline. But you bring up a really good point, which is, how do you use Facebook or Google or any of these sites sort of without giving up some information? And I suppose the answer is you can't, but I suppose I feel more comfortable doing it with a brand that I know and trust than with some no-name app that I've never heard of. And the thing that's most important here is that in all of these cases, you can choose.
You can choose to opt out of Facebook, for instance, altogether. You could go to a different platform, Instagram, Twitter. You could decide that you're going to roll back a couple generations and stick to email.
Well, and it is also all of the browsers that we now use make it very easy to go in and delete en masse all of your cookies as well as all of your browsing history on a regular basis. I happen to actually like to keep all that stuff, but lots of people on a routinely go in and purge the kind purge all this data just to make sure that people aren't tracking them.
I'm a cookie purger. I'll just say that right now. Well, this takes the conversation a slightly different direction, but it's very compelling. Ben asks, are there any new players in the market, particularly in China, that might threaten Google or Apple's dominance? Also, what's the coming frontier for these tech giants? But let's go to that first question first. Companies that might be threatening Google or Apple's dominance.
Well, if I knew the companies in China that were right, that were going to threaten Apple and Google's dominance today or tomorrow, I'd be writing about it because I think what's going on in China is fascinating and interesting, and I think bears watching. But you know, I'm sure that it's going on. I'm sure that it's going on here. I mean, one of the things that I find myself often going back to is the hearing in front of Orrin Hatch in Washington in 1998, where Bill Gates, at the peak of his power, was asked whether or not he thought Microsoft had a monopoly. And Gates said in front of
the world
that he didn't think so. And he said he didn't think so because he thought that the barriers to entry in technology were so low that any company in a garage could be at that very moment starting up and trying to unseat Microsoft. Well, in 1998, the company that was starting, that was just starting up, that ultimately I would argue did unseat Microsoft, was Google. And so it's important to understand that this stuff moves very, very, very quickly.
You've been covering Silicon Valley for years now. Were there any surprises for you as you reported for Dogfight?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of surprises. I mean, the thing that I found really surprising was just how hard it is to create products that change the world. I mean, the kind of effort that goes into building this stuff is really incredible. I mean, I think one of the things that people forget, and this is as much Silicon Valley companies' fault as it is our own, is innovation is not a straight line. I think that, you know, Apple and Google and all these companies, in an effort to put their best foot forward, always want the world to believe that it started at point A and went to point B in a very, very straight line. Well, the answer is it never works that way. And, you know, what was really interesting about digging into the development of the iPhone, the development of Android, is that there were as many failures as there were successes, and there was far more anxiety and worry about whether or not such and such an idea was going to work or such and such a design was going to work than any of the companies would have you believe. Go ahead.
So let's talk about that. I mean, Apple had a certain kind of stomach for risk in the years that you're talking about. But Silicon Valley and the march of technology ever forward, you know, months have passed since this script went for publishing and now the book is out. One listener writes, Google is really showing its age or perhaps its middle management bloat in its failure to respond nimbly to the superiority of iOS and Objective-C. Pete writes, with $100 billion in the bank, Apple can afford to take risks. Are these companies middle-aged? Have they lost their appetite for risk?
I don't think so at all. I mean, I hope that Apple, with all the money that it has, and I think it has $150 billion, hasn't lost its appetite for risk. Certainly, it has the bankroll to take enormous risks. And I'm really, really interested to see what the next killer product coming out of Apple is going to be. I have to say I've come to worry a little bit of late that I haven't seen that killer product, because I think that one of the things that Apple, one of the issues that Apple has to deal with as a company, and this is just the way it's set up as a business, is that it really has to boil the ocean every 3 to 5 years in order to be successful. So if you go back to the iPod, I mean, the iPod was incredibly dominant for 5 years. Competitors started to catch up. They came out with the iPhone. That was incredibly dominant for 3 years until Android started to catch up. And then they came out with the iPad. And that was incredibly dominant for 3 years until the tablet started, the Android tablet started to catch up. And so I think Apple, even though it's making more money than ever before, Apple really needs to come up with yet another product that boils the ocean. As for Google, I think that it's really interesting to actually take a look. If you look more closely at Google, I think what you'll find is a company that is has an appetite for risk that is quite remarkable.
Let's turn again to the phones. We've got Paul in Vallejo.
Hi. Thanks for the conversation. I'm really enjoying it. I thought I'd comment a little bit about relevant advertising. I'm 77 years old and calling on one of these miracle devices. And last night when I was watching television, it was occurring to me that in all of the years that I've watched, I've never once that I can remember bought anything that I saw advertised on television. It might have influenced me a little bit. On the other hand, when I do a Google search or when I'm on Amazon and I see something recommended that is dovetailed with my taste and with my what it is that I actually enjoy, well, I'm very happy to take some of those recommendations. And, in fact, I have purchased things under those circumstances.
So a happy customer there.
Well, and I think one of the issues that you bring up, it is something that bedevils the television industry right now. I mean, obviously, there's a difference between the kind of advertising that we see on Google and on the internet in general and the kind of advertising that we see on television in terms of what they're hoping to get you to do. On the other hand, I think the networks would be very, very happy if there was a way for us to see one of their ads and buy right then and there.
You know, Bob writes, the teacher who called in earlier made an excellent point about the generation gap in regards to advertising. The internet is only free because of advertising. And I think my generation has made peace with that. I certainly prefer the ads to having to pay for each site I'd like to use. But it sounds like what we've just heard over the phones as well, that it's not necessarily a generational thing. It has to do with whether you feel you're, in a sense, getting a service from these targeted ads.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that I think that one of the ideas behind Google's relevant advertising in particular was just that. They felt that, I mean, I have heard Larry Page talk about this, that if you gave people advertising that made, that was actually relevant to them rather than irrelevant to them, they actually wouldn't necessarily see it as advertising in the pejorative sense. They would see it as information that was actually useful for them at that particular time. And I think that's the magic of Google's success, actually.
Mark in San Jose. Oh, I think we've lost him. Let's keep going. How about Timothy in San Jose? Are you still there?
Rachel and Fred, regarding the dogfight book. A lot of commentators have touched lightly on the geopolitical aspects of the so-called rivalry between Apple and others. But it seems, doesn't it to you, like when you look at certain events that happen, such as the Asiana crash in San Francisco, coming from where it came from, South Korea, but it had Chinese passengers, and at the last moment there was a premonition that Sheryl Sandberg had, and she took her Google, her Facebook executive group off that flight. It seems, doesn't it to you, that there might be a deeper struggle when you look at you know, the business page and you see the clashes between the companies? Is there, does it represent actually a deeper struggle, a geopolitical struggle that's going on in the world today?
Well, that's a really, really good question. I think that all these companies compete around the world, and so that's absolutely true. I think that it's also absolutely true that all these companies have sort of a very love-hate relationship with China in particular, which is interesting if you've read some Chinese history, because the West has always had a love-hate relationship with China. They've always been in love with the giant size of the with the enormous size of the Chinese population, and always been somewhat bedeviled in their efforts to penetrate that market. And I think you're still seeing that. I think one of the things that was interesting to note was that Apple, after 7 years of trying, was just able to kind of get a deal with one of the top Chinese telecom companies to distribute iPhones in China. I think that so the answer is, yeah, this is a, there's absolutely a geopolitical aspect to all of this, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
It does seem like we're dealing with companies that are global in nature. They have global people designing the products, producing the products, marketing the products, and yet they function within these nation states that are fundamentally 19th century in intellectual scope and structure.
Well, I think that, you know, that's been true about that's been true about corporations. This is a debate we've been having about corporations for certainly as long as I've been alive, and maybe as long as my parents have been alive. I think that you know, who do corporations answer to? Do they answer to the nations like the United States that they're based in? Or do they answer to the nations that they say do the most business in? I would tend to argue that really international policing, being as I suppose ineffective as it is, I would argue that really the only way to police corporations globally is to make sure that they that the countries in which they're based have the ability to actually police them. And 'cause otherwise you wind up with, as you said, Rachel, pseudo countries on their own who are accountable to no one.
Well, speaking of law, you spend a lot of time in Dogfight talking about patent law, court battles, you know, lots of people within Silicon Valley decry the situation with patents today, you know, beg for new laws. But at the same time, these companies are playing the game.
You know, I think that I wish I had a good answer to the whole patent war that's going on, especially between Samsung and Apple, Samsung being the proxy for Android and Apple being the company suing Samsung for copying its designs and ideas in from the iPhone. I wish I had a good answer there. What I can say, though, is, and this was surprising to me, is that the kinds of debates that we're having right now feel like they're new, but if you actually go back into history, they're actually not new at all. I mean, we have really, since the beginning of the whole patent system in the 19th or 18th century, companies have been, entrepreneurs have been trying to use the courts to get their way, and the courts have said, why are you asking us to try to figure this out when we have no basis to figure this out? We're not engineers. We're not scientists. And there's been a... So the fight that is going on now is actually a lot more rooted in historical behavior than I think a lot of people understood.
And perhaps it's another signal that we, all of us, need to get better at understanding the science and the engineering behind these products that we use.
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think that it's probably hard to, you don't want to ask people to do too much, otherwise they don't buy your products. On the other hand, we got to understand how televisions work, and so I guess we're going to have to understand how the phones we carry in our pockets work, too.
Well, Fred Vogelstein, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been fascinating.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Fred Vogelstein is the author of Dogfight, How Apple and Google Went to War and Started a Revolution. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.